When did you last feel that Western economies were in a decent state? Perhaps not organised in the way that you would like, but at least growing. You might have to look fairly far back in time, because since the 2008 financial crisis, the European and North American economies haven't been doing so well. They are struggling with low growth. They need massive amounts of central bank support. Sure, there are jobs, but many face crippling levels of super-exploitation and stagnating wages, and this mix has been creating very high levels of economic inequality. Today we ask, is it time to decide that low growth is a permanent state we have to adapt to? And, if we do, could this help us focus efforts on dealing with inequality, creating new economic incentives and systems, rather than trying and failing to restart traditional capitalist growth with all the problems that entails? Perhaps we might even ask whether we need something called growth or capitalism at all.
I want you to deal with your problems by becoming rich!
You have this fundamentally unsound system built on a foundation of sand instead of bedrock, and it was rotted from the core.
If the peasants ever chose to exercise their democratic rights, the pillaging by the wealthy would be over.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host Zoe Williams. Today we're joined by ecological economist Tim Jackson. Tim's the director of the Centre for the Understanding of Sustainable Prosperity. We'll be talking to him about his brilliant new book, Post-Growth, Life After Capitalism, just published by Polity Press. You can feed back to us on the show and feed in ideas on what you'd like us to cover in the future by emailing podcast@anothereurope.org.
Hi, this is Elena. Back in the 2016 referendum, I was just your regular politically active migrant. So I was so happy when I found Another Europe is possible. I grew up in Bulgaria, and my opportunities to move to the UK 8 years ago to study and to change my life and to change my politics even basically came through membership of the European Union. So it's sad that we're now living through the Brexit that we warned about back then. But that's why we need to keep going, because none of the issues and none of the problems have gone away. So that's why I think you should join us today. Go to anothereurope.org and you can get access to an extended version of this podcast by making Another Europe is Possible your home too.
Welcome to the podcast, Tim. I have to say, your book is so readable. I really want to get that across first and foremost. Anybody who thinks it's going to be much too hard should try reading it.
Thank you. Thanks, Zoe. I think that's quite important for a book, really.
Well, you say that, but there aren't many academics who would subscribe to it, I don't think.
Zoe's just putting that health warning out there because she knows that in the course of the next 45 minutes, I'm going to make it sound unbearably complicated.
I'm going to try and resist that, Lee.
So to go to the big question first, what is capitalism, and does it, or why does it, always need to be growing?
It's kind of, it sort of depends who you ask. That's the trouble, Zoe. It's, you know, if you ask, basically, if you ask a kind of Marxist, they equate capitalism with accumulation, and accumulation means growth. So you end up with a growth-based system. If you ask for a kind of slightly more political economy question, you get an answer like, well, capitalism is about the private ownership of the means of production, which sort of sounds, you know, opaque and tells you virtually nothing about why it should grow. And I think probably, you know, the central point for me is that at the heart of how capitalism thinks of enterprise is that it's a process of profit maximization, and that means reducing your costs, and one of your costs is labor. So you want to increase the productivity of your labor as much and as fast as you can, and that's your principal motivation for going into business. So inevitably, if you're doing that, you're kind of either putting people out of work or you have to grow the economy.
your observation is that since the 60s, basically, growth is something you chase, but you have no control over.
It's been harder and harder to get. Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I mean, you know, when I was looking at those statistics for the first time, and, you know, you kind of think, well, yeah, things were really good. Things were really booming in the 60s. There was growth rates of 4% and 5% per year. And underlying that, there was this growth in this labor productivity, the productivity of our time in the economy, of around about the same rate, 4% and 5% per year. But if you look at the trends over time of that particular feature of the economy, that labor productivity number, you find that it declines steadily. And in fact, even before the pandemic, it was in the UK, it was pretty much below zero. It's a feature more of advanced economies than emerging economies, I would say, that decline in labor productivity growth. But it's very, very marked. It's very, very clear to see. And the kind of problem with that, I think, is that instead of recognizing that and figuring out how to make an economy work, which isn't necessarily, you know, chasing labor productivity all the time, what we've tried to do is to chase growth in spite of that. And we've made a lot of ideological assumptions about how the best way to do that is, not the least of which is that if we prefer the interests of the capital markets over everybody else, then that will eventually trickle down to the poorest in society. And you know, as we know, that just didn't happen.
And on that point, I mean, particularly since the 2008 financial crisis, one response has been really intensifying the super exploitation of labour, right, with the rise of zero-hour contracts, this extreme flexibilization of the bottom end of the labour market. And that's a feature, presumably, of being able to achieve a relatively high employment in a situation of stagnant growth. Is that right?
That's exactly right. There is always, if you like, if you think about it from the perspective of a firm, you sell something, a product or a service, and you get some revenues from that. And out of that, you've got three things to do. One is to pay your workers. The other is to pay your shareholders, if you're owned by shareholders. And the third is to invest in tomorrow, to kind of put in place the infrastructures and the investments that you need to keep going in business. And so when the margins are squeezed, which is what happens when you can't reduce costs, those things enter into a competition with each other, basically. And that, you know, the classical kind of almost Marxist competition is the one between workers and capitalists, so between wages and dividends. And if you like, a kind of environmental version of that is the conflict between today and tomorrow, between the present wages or the present dividends and the future investments. And so what I think what we've seen is a kind of systematic squeezing of that situation. And the rules of the game have quite distinctly favored dividends over both wages and investments. And that's led to a kind of situation where we underinvest in relation to tomorrow. We don't do the investments we need to make in climate change, for example, or in combating climate change. And we squeeze the conditions of and the incomes of workers. And you would expect to see that reflected in falling real investment and rising inequality. And you do. That's basically what the trend of. And it isn't just since the financial crisis. It's actually predates the financial crisis.
Some people would argue that in order to get higher wages, you need higher productivity. And what we see in Western economies is basically a productivity crisis, a lack of investment. Would you agree with that perspective?
That's been the classical bargain. I mean, I don't think it's absolutely right. The bargain that's sort of struck in neoclassical economics is that wages, that workers deserve the wages that are associated with their productivity. So if their productivity goes up, you should pay them more. And the flip side, of course, is if their productivity doesn't go up, you shouldn't pay them more. But actually, when you look at the question a little bit more deeply, you find it isn't really as simple as that. That kind of simple moral argument that you should pay people as fast as they work, it sort of bypasses a lot of the question of where the value in society is, how that value was created, who owns the value that lives in the technologies that displace the workers and who should benefit from that. So you find, for example, you know, that one of the ways to get rid of workers is to invest in new technologies. One of the ways to get new technologies to do R&D. One of the ways to do R&D is to get the government to pay for it. And if you're very clever, like as some tech companies have been, you then avoid paying any kind of tax on any of the activity that you engage in to produce those wonderful new technologies and displace all those workers. So that the government, essentially the public sector, is cross-subsidizing the ability to get rid of workers for firms and generate big profits out of that process. And that's, I think, you know, that's, I think, where that simplistic equation just goes wrong. It probably never was the case, really, that productivity should have been associated precisely with workers for all sorts of reasons, not the least of which is that some of the most valuable workers in society are not productive in that conventional sense at all. You can't count their output in terms of, you know, increases to the gross domestic product. It's care workers is my favorite example of that. You know, you don't ask carers to contribute to the GDP, you ask them to look after people. And that's a very different kind of work. It's a productivity that isn't measured in that conventional labor productivity sense. And if all you're doing is chasing that labor productivity in a way that's the only way that you can think about increasing people's wages is if they increase their labor productivity, then the most valuable people in society end up being penalized by it.
To talk about a bit more about profit in an era of low growth, I mean, we kind of, you know, if people find it really difficult to accept that growth is a chimera, and certainly difficult to accept that we've been in a kind of stagnant period for longer than a decade. But I think people would also find it very confusing, the relationship between growth and profits, because, you know, to think specifically about Deliveroo and the kind of disaster of its share price and the fact that it can't turn a profit even when we're all literally stuck at home waiting for it, do we have to also reimagine our relationship with profit and our expectation of profit?
Yeah, I think we do. You know, in an economy which is trending towards a more or less stationary growth, trending towards zero in terms of growth, let me put it more simply. If you're declining towards zero, if your growth rate is declining towards zero, then ultimately you can't expect your profits and your share prices to be endlessly growing. That was the point actually that Thomas Piketty made in Capital in the 21st Century. And he was quite forthright about it, that he kind of pinpointed the source of the inequality in society, the growing inequality that he and his colleagues had documented. And he pointed the finger really at the declining growth rate and said it's coming out of that. Now, I think that's not always entirely true. It doesn't necessarily come out of that, but it does come out of that if you continue to prioritize profit, the growth in share price, and the dividends that flow through capital markets to the people who end up being the richest in society. It's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way, that if you don't rethink that, if you don't think about where profit is distributed, how it should be allocated, how fast it can grow in the economy, who gets access to it, and indeed what it's drawn from, where that profit is drawn from. If you don't start thinking about all those things, then you end up kind of where we have ended up, which is a sort of assumption that those who own the shares that generate the profit, protected by government mechanisms and not even forced to pay tax in some cases, then you end up with that huge inequality that Piketty was highlighting.
I mean, this is quite a kind of classic Fordist point, isn't it? That the workers have to be able to afford the cars, otherwise the cars won't get sold.
Yeah, it is. I mean, Ford made it, Keynes made it. You can't... Ultimately, if you don't have enough wages in the economy to purchase the goods that you're producing with this huge productivity, the economy is going to slow down. It's possible that we're seeing that because of this, you know, slowing down in labor productivity. It's possible that that's also driving the lack of investment that will make us more and more productive. And some people have made that point. I think there's a lot of economists who would sort of agree with some of that analysis about the slowing down of productivity and point the finger at actually, you know, capitalism having too much interest in the proceeds of production and workers not having enough. And I think, you know, that's a really solid point. But I think what it kind of misses, and it's the point that I, you know, have tried to draw out, I suppose, from this story, is that actually that if the only way of solving all those problems is faster and faster productivity growth, what on earth are we going to do to the planet? And how on earth are we going to protect those jobs that matter most, the ones that don't contribute in that way to this massive productivity growth?
Could I ask another follow-up question with a different case study? Because very similar to the Deliveroo example is, of course, Uber. I mean, Uber have been hemorrhaging like money in losing money year on year, despite these huge rising revenues, extraordinary levels of income that it has, but still losing money at the level of profit. Now, the big hope for Uber was technological change, driverless cars. And the reason I'm thinking about this today is that there's this example that one of the Tesla vehicles has this autopilot function, not meant to be used without a driver in the car, but can be very easily duped into thinking there is a driver in the car and can be run driverless. Now, this suggests that driverless cars are many, many years away, much further away than Uber expected when it did its initial IPO offering. So does this technological change, how does that fit with your argument, Tim, as around this idea of what tomorrow looks like?
I suppose if you like, you know, that technological narrative is a very, very familiar one. You know, you listen to a couple of speeches from Elon Musk or anybody else that the second richest man in the world manages to influence with his ideas. And you kind of think, you know, wow, the future is here. I want one of those. Give me one of those. And even if, you know, as an individual, I don't necessarily want to use that turn on autopilot function in my Tesla, I'd really like a Tesla. You know, it's an exciting narrative. It's sexy. It talks to a sort of a future that's filled with unlimited possibility. And that narrative is very, very common. And then there's a kind of dark side, a shadow narrative, which says, well, if that happens, you know, what are you going to do with all the poor people who don't have jobs anymore? And how are you going to deal with that inequality? And so that narrative tends to come up with a solution which is based around redistribution, which sort of says, well, these, you know, technology giants are getting really rich very fast and there's no control over that. So we need a social solution which moves that income or taxes at a source, or argues that they could only develop those technologies on the back of public science and public knowledge anyway, so they don't really own that those technology rights, and that you therefore distribute that income to the people and the parts of society that we want. Now, I'm not entirely against that way of fixing what is otherwise a dystopian narrative, but I think there's something fundamental that goes kind of missing out of it, which is, you know, if self-driving Teslas to solve Uber's problem is the answer, then what is the question? And there you kind of, you know, the question is, you know, how can you solve capitalism when capitalism's running away from itself with technologies that disenfranchise people and ruin the planet? And that seems to be, you know, that answer to solving the problems that capitalism's created seems to miss. And again, I come back to this point because it's really central for me. It misses the fact that an economy of care and craft and creativity, sectors with really quite low productivity growth rates, is something that offers us the fundamental basis for social stability. It improves the quality of our life. It is low carbon. It offers masses of employment because there is never a deficit of care jobs. And yet capitalism cannot afford it. And that, it seems to me, is the question. That is the question. How can we afford a society that is good for us, good for people, good for the planet, and in some sense egalitarian, and protects the jobs that matter most in society? And I don't think self-driving Teslas that satisfy Uber's demand for its shareholders to get richer faster is the answer to that question.
How is the story kind of outside the OECD different to this? I mean, we talk about kind of developed countries being particularly stagnant, but are the very high growth rates reported in other parts of the world, are they real or are they massaged or is it a combination?
It's a combination. I mean, some of it is real. Some of it is real manufacturing that produces the goods that are then exported to the bits of the world that no longer produce them. And so, you know, the sense in which those parts of the world became the factory of the world over the last few decades is real. And because that's growth-based, you know, that's kind of real manufacturing, producing things, it actually is amenable to more productivity growth than, for example, service-based sectors are. So there are places in the world that are still growing and profiting from that labour productivity growth. It has slowed down. You can see some of those trends of slowing of labour productivity growth underneath it at the world level even. But it's nothing like as fast as has happened in the most developed countries, in the so-called advanced economies. And then, of course, you have to kind of say that in those places, certainly some of the poorest of those places, that income growth is very definitely needed, and particularly needed if it's dedicated to improving the conditions of life in those countries. Because in some, you know, we're still looking at 2 billion people kind of below the poverty line without access to clean energy or clean water. And that's, you know, there is a point to growth in those places, and there is a point to improving living conditions in those places. So the growth, I think, that is built around that reduction of poverty, particularly in those countries, is not, you know, it's not something that at this point, I think, it's not something that we should denigrate. It's not something we should kind of throw out.
So a quick plug before we get back to the discussion with Tim. Sometimes it feels like nothing can be done about Brexit, that we just have to accept the terrible Tory deal. It's not an argument we at Another Europe agree with. That's why I've just written a new report. It picks apart the problems with Boris Johnson's terrible trade deal and outlines a clear and comprehensive strategy on how it can be reformed. To read it, go to anothereurope.org/reformeudeal.pdf. That's anothereurope.org/reformeudeal.pdf. So there's this point in the book, I suppose it's one of those shocking, not surprising things. You point out that a recent report showed farm workers in the UK who were growing, of course, food, agricultural workers, didn't have enough money for food and were using food banks. This is obviously an appalling situation. So how do we get from that to anything good happening?
The book is really about kind of vision and values as much as anything else. And I suppose I see that as a fundamental question of what we value in society and how we reflect that value. And so the starting point to answer that question to me is, you know, which bits of our economy really matter? What is the worth of a nurse? What is the worth of a farm worker? And to answer that question, you kind of then have to go to a place where you say, well, what happens if we had to do without them? And in some sense, that is the question that the pandemic asked of us, forced us to face, because of the additional burden on them, because of the difficulties associated with the distribution system, because of the sudden need actually to focus really clearly on getting food to people and looking after people who had fallen sick. And what that told us was that the people working in the food distribution system from farm gate to fork and prior, and the people working in our care system, both in the community and in the overcrowded hospitals, were the most valuable people in society. And yet they had been the people who had fallen foul of this dysfunctional system, which had allocated wages on the basis of, only on the basis of, a productivity growth measured in a certain way. So it seems to me that you have to kind of start with mechanisms that redress our failure to recognize the value of those people. the book is not so much about the mechanisms to do that, although Prosperity Without Growth, which was the predecessor, did talk about some of them. But you can certainly, you know, you can certainly think of mechanisms that do that. You can think of wage policies, and a living wage policy is the very bare minimum that you have to think about there. But you also should perhaps think about maximum wage policies, so there aren't huge differentials. You can think about ownership structures, about who owns the assets associated with those things. You have to look at the financial markets, because I think one of the things that's destroying, in a way, is destroying the agricultural supply chain and creating poverty along the supply chain, is that at the bottom end, at the end of farmers, you have farmers who are working with rates of return that are around about zero to the investments they make. They virtually don't make any profit whatsoever in many, and certainly in the family farms, the subsistence farms, the rural farms. You know, they're not huge profit makers. And yet the system that they are supplying is a system that is increasingly trying to squeeze profit out of it in pursuit of the share prices for dividend holders. And so that financial mechanism is what is squeezing the wages at the point in the system, which is only able to generate 0% rate of return. And all of the mechanisms that we put in fact, you know, for example, there's been a lot of talk about biodiversity offsets as payments into the farming community to protect, for example, the value of land as a means to absorb CO2. And so you kind of, you know, you've got this potential mechanism that puts more money into the hands of farmers, puts more money into the hands of agricultural workers, potentially. And yet all of the ways that's been talked about as setting up are extractive. They are drawing those potential biodiversity offsets. They're selling essentially those potential biodiversity offsets to people who are outside of that system, because then you can scale it up, then you can look at a rate of return on it, then you can launch it on a stock market somewhere, you can sell it as a part of a financial mechanism on the financial market. And it looks like a moneymaker, but it's doing exactly the wrong thing. What we want is a system that actually puts that money directly into the hands of the people who are earning at the moment virtually no return and having to pay themselves and their workers nothing. So those, you know, that's all, in a way, it's about architecture and design. It's about recognizing where value lies and creating the mechanisms that can support it. And that goes from everything from, you know, job guarantees to minimum wage policies to maximum wage policies to universal basic incomes to a wage policy that simply protects and ring fences those workers who really matter and figures out the payment problem at a different level, figures out the payment problem at the point of a national budget. And that, I think, you know, that I think is the approach that has completely gone missing under an ideological framework which says that you only pay workers to the extent that they contribute to the productivity that results in the gross value added at the macro level of the economy.
Some people in this space are quite anti the very idea of work. You know, there's a huge amount coming out of the Greens and NEF on just everybody working less. But your analysis is quite different to that. You draw on Hannah Arendt's The World Building Task of Work. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I'm not against the idea that we have less in the way of formal work. In fact, I contributed to some of the work that NEF was doing on this a few years ago. There's a book called 21 Hours, I think, that was put out. And I have a chapter in that. And my chapter was a sort of, you know, okay, getting rid of work is great. If you have labor productivity, we don't all have to work so much in the economy. We can take the dividends of that as more time for ourselves, for our family. That's got a huge pedigree. Keynes wrote about it in 1930 in an essay called Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren. It is a way of thinking about that puzzle. But I suppose what I was drawn to is, and it starts in a very geeky way from the sort of mathematics of it, is that sometimes you don't necessarily have that labor productivity growth. Sometimes in the things that matter, you put a lot of time into something for an output that doesn't contribute to the GDP at all, or not very much, or not very measurably, and that is a valuable part of what work is about, because it's about our service to other people, because it is about our sense of having of engaging in a task in the world, and because it also contributes to this sense that of almost of meaning and purpose, that we are building a sense of our own continuity as a society. And that's the point where I draw. I mean, Arendt is really interesting because she distinguishes between kind of two types of things, which we would use interchangeably, but she distinguishes between labor, which is that caring work, which is one thing which is not particularly productive in conventional sense, and work, which is the kind of, you know, once we've satisfied our basic requirements, once we lift our eyes from the task of sustenance. She's very interesting about this because she sort of says, well, actually, it's a good thing in a way. You know, we've solved that basic problem, but we're faced with another one, which is we have too much time to think about our own mortality. And that drives us into a different kind of task around work, which is the task of building, if you like, defenses against our anxiety about our mortality. And the most interesting thing about those defenses is that they should entail some form of continuity. They should offer us a sense of continuity. They should be things that last. They should be durable and beautiful and culturally informative, and they should give us a sense of ourselves that goes beyond the visceral reality of our mortal lives. And I, you know, I think it's a beautiful conception of work. I think it's a really, it draws on that sense of how work can be, in the right circumstances, important to the individual because of that sense of losing yourself in the task, becoming part of something greater, contributing to a sense of continuity. So it's good at the kind of individual level. It's good at the social level if you can create that durability, because it does offer a sort of security about our place on the planet and the human condition. That was the title of Anna Arendt's book, The Human Condition. It offers a response to the human condition. And yet, you know, the striking thing is how actually inimical to capitalism that is, because if you have things which are durable, then you don't need to make so much anymore. And if you don't need to make so much anymore, then you can't gain profit from it, and it's difficult to employ people. So you end up actually in both places, both in labor, which is denigrated in society and relegated to the lowest division, and in work, which is supposed to be this almost ephemeral task of confronting our own mortality, you end up destroying the value of both of those places where human time is allocated. And that's, you know, that to me is also, it's also the grounds for it. It's the starting point. It's the launching pad for that different valuation of what we're doing. We conflate labor and work. We only associate the gains of work with monetary outcomes. We distribute people's livelihoods according to those associated gains of productivity growth, and we end up destroying both the integrity of our care system and our most fundamental task as human beings, which is to see a point in our lives and in our society, and to confront that anxiety that we are associated with inevitably because of our mortality. And those then become the tasks. The task then becomes, in fact, to place both of those things at the center of what we're doing and devise our economies in ways which make sense of them.
Fantastic. That's so inspirational and lucid, Tim. It makes me think of my favorite novel or series of novels, Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars Trilogy, a great path-breaking science fiction novels from the 1990s, and they have exactly the same conception of work. If listeners want to see what this realistic utopia might look like, the novels discuss a group of individuals that actually show that work can be something else. It can be something liberatory, because they're contributing to the production of value in a new utopian society. And they love the work. They love the creation of this new type of community and the scientific discovery and the conservation of the world around them and the transformation of the world around them that involves.
I remember reading that a long time ago, and I need to go back and reread it. But, you know, you can also go to William Morris and News from Nowhere, and he offers he offers a kind of conception of work which is not dissimilar. You know, it's one in which actually workers are not kind of paid at all. And the narrator of that guest goes around, what do you mean we're not paid? You know, why would anyone work then? And the answer is, you know, what's the rewards of labor if you're not getting paid? And the guide through Nowhere, this fictitious utopia, says the reward of labor is life. And that's almost in a nutshell says it tackles both of those issues, both the undermining of care and the undermining of a kind of vision for living in one. So, and I guess a part of what I was trying to do in the book was to sort of say this depth of thinking about who we are and where we are, what kind of society we want and how our economy works, this depth of thinking already exists. You can go to these, you know, wonderful science fiction novels. You can go to 19th century literature. You can go to 2000 BC China, and you can find wisdom and learning that speaks to the human condition that we are busy sweeping aside because we are captured by an ideology that is reaching its limits. And so part of what I wanted to do in Post-Growth was kind of draw those things to the surface, to create a kind of thread, to see them as a source of inspiration and ideas for confronting the challenges that we have at the moment. And to tell the stories, actually, to tell the stories of the people who thought in those ways and show some of the continuity between the way they tackled the problems and the challenges that we face today.
This is either going to sound like a very obvious question or a much too large question, but how do we get from here to saving the planet? I mean, is it necessary now to embrace post-growth, to embrace no growth in order to make it work?
It is a huge question, obviously. And I suppose a couple of things to say to it. One is I'm not sure that it's about embracing no growth. I think what it is, it's about giving up the constraint of growth. And it has been a very powerful constraint. I mean, when I started out, and I was working for environmental NGOs at that time, and our rationale would be, you know, very clear. It would be, we have to show the people in charge that there are solutions that exist that we could afford or put in place that would not disturb the status quo too much, that would fit within this kind of model of growth. And you know, my earliest work was really interestingly kind of around those sort of technological solutions and not really questioning the big drivers of the economic system. And increasingly, as I watched that, you know, being ignored, marginalized, not implemented, and to some extent, and then later a little bit kind of colonized within the economic system, I began to realize that the reason that things weren't moving so fast was this absolute affiliation to a kind of mantra of expansive growth and productivity. And that was the thing that stood in the way of the technologies that we might want, the kinds of social systems that we might want, the kind of workers that we might want to reward, were all being thwarted by that mantra. And so for me, it's not about, you know, kind of going to a dial somewhere in Treasury labeled growth and turning it downwards. It's actually about going to that dial and ripping it off the wall and focusing then from there on the things that we need to do. And we know that we need to, you know, curtail carbon emissions. We know that we need to protect workers who are very, very precarious. We know, in fact, actually, that sometimes those two things go together. So a lot of what's talked about in terms of green jobs, for example, is often, you know, you believe that that's kind of people making wind turbines or photovoltaics in factories somewhere. But that's, when you look at it from a macroeconomic point of view, when you look at the kind of statistics macroeconomically, what you find is that the lowest intensity of carbon and the highest intensity of employment is precisely in those sectors that we want. That's those sectors of personal, human, social services that create the fabric of society and that protect our lives. They are both low carbon and they are high intensity of employment because of this low productivity growth that they embody. And the only thing that has gone missing is the structure to make that the most important sector in society. And I suppose, so that's, you know, that's why I think these two, it's kind of how I got into, you know, this sort of thinking about the structure of the economy and the productivity was precisely through that need to figure out why the technological solution was not leading us where we wanted it to go in relation to climate change. So I do think, I mean, I think in a way, I would say, you know, I'm not saying we shouldn't do that technology. I'm not saying we shouldn't implement the legislation that's needed to reduce carbon emissions. I'm offering here something on the table, which I believe is a fundamental component of that transition, which is to focus on those sectors which are inherently low in carbon and inherently high in quality and really matter to society.
That concludes this episode for those listening on the podcast platforms. But the discussion isn't over. An extended version of this podcast is available to members of Another Europe Is Possible. In this week's Extra Time, we asked Tim what his recommendations would be for politicians in Britain or indeed across Europe, and how the new green agenda of the Biden administration fits in with all these debates. It's a good chat. If you want to listen to it, just sign up to our people-powered movement. Another Europe is the home of the pro-European left. You can join at anotheureupe.org/join. It doesn't cost much at all and makes a big difference.